This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. If you're having trouble keeping us straight, just remember, the guy with the southern twang, that's a three-syllable word, that's Ed, our 19th century guy. The guy with the northern twang, that's me, Brian, your 20th century guy.
And when you don't hear any twang at all, it's me, Peter Onuf, 18th century American history guy.
Today, we're talking about the history of voting in America. In the first part of the show, we looked at what actually happens on Election Day, who gets to vote, how they vote, and in some cases, how those votes are actually manipulated by people running the whole shebang. But there's still a big part of voting that we haven't talked about, and that's what happens after the votes are counted.
When it comes to state and local elections, the process is fairly straightforward. People vote, and the candidate with the most votes wins. Yeah, sure, there are some screwy rules here and there, runoff elections, things like that. But basically, it comes down to one person, one vote. But when it comes to presidential elections, it's a whole different story. And if the details of that story are a little fuzzy to you, don't worry. You're not alone. You've got plenty of company, at least here in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Are you planning to vote?
Yes.
Sure. Of course.
Once you cast a ballot, how does that elect a president?
Okay. There we go.
I guess it gets calculated and tallied up.
I guess it counts towards the overall election status.
Well, I hope my vote counts for the man that I vote for.
It goes to the state, which then goes to the federal.
Through the electoral, stuff like that.
How does my vote help elect a president?
Doesn't really, does it?
How does it elect a president? Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine they all get counted up, added together, and the one with the most votes wins.
What about that Electoral College?
Each state designated to populace or something. I'm really not sure. Now I'm sounding... Am I right?
Give me that again.
I think it's like somehow linked to the popular vote, but in a state, but not necessarily.
I know it has to do with the red states, the blue states, and the gray ones, which are the hinge states, is that right?
Swing states.
The swing states, ah, yes.
I'm sorry, I don't know enough about it to talk to you about it.
And then they use the, what are the people that, the superdelegates.
I don't want to do this anymore.
Well, guys, at least no one claimed to have graduated from that Electoral College.
Well, that's a little civics quiz administered by our producer, Rachel Quimby, in downtown Charlottesville, where there is a college, surprisingly enough.
guys, restrain yourselves. We've had a civics quiz. Let's have a civics lesson. How about it? How does this Electoral College thing work?
Well, Peter, I'm going to ask you. I mean, you know, this they did this back in your period.
Yeah, fair enough. I like that.
Well, first off, let's do the basic math. Take Delaware. Delaware is the smallest state in the original Union, three little counties dangling south of Pennsylvania, as you can see on your map even today. Those three counties constitute one state. That means two senators and one representative in the Electoral College. You got the formula here. It's the number of representatives plus the number of senators, and those electors vote in turn when the college convenes in order to name the president. You are not voting for a president. You are voting for an elector.
So let's take a state like Wyoming, okay. All right? If you figure out how many people are behind each elector in Wyoming, it's going to be something like 250,000 people for each elector. If you take California, it's going to be something like 600,000 people per each elector. So what that means is you can have a swing of 300,000 votes between those two states. In the popular vote, that's a 300,000 advantage, but no advantage in the Electoral College. So you have this situation, which has happened four times in history, 1824 or 1876. I think the third was 1888. And of course, 2000, where a candidate racks up the popular vote, but they don't win the electoral votes because those electoral votes are aggregated on the state level and the winner takes all. I mean, this is enough to make you wonder what the founders could possibly have been thinking when they came up with the system in the first place. Recently, I put this very question to Alexander Kasar, an historian at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
What they were thinking about was getting out of Philadelphia at the end of the summer.
because, you know, it was hot and they had been there too long. In the course of the summer, and it does go on for the entire summer, they changed their decision about how to choose the president a bunch of times. The most frequent thing that they do is to say that the president should be chosen by the legislature, in effect, by Congress.
So kind of a what today we would call a parliamentary system of sorts.
Something like a parliamentary system. They're uneasy about it the whole time they're doing it. There is a thought that if we want the president to be able to be reelected, he should not be chosen by Congress because that would, in effect, make him subject to the caprices and manipulations of Congress.
So how do you really have a separate branch of government in the executive?
Exactly. So that's part of what they struggle with. A second option is election by the people. And that is something of a non-starter, really, because of the South. I mean, that if there had been popular election of the president, then the Southern states would not have gotten any bonus in political power for their slaves.
Yeah. And Alex, explain that to me, that bonus for their slaves. The slaves didn't vote, of course. So what would the bonus taken away have been with a direct vote?
Well, sure. Well, earlier in the summer, one of the big issues that they settled had to do with slavery and had to do with small states and big states. And the way in which they dealt with slavery was, you know, what became known rather notoriously as the Three-Fifths Compromise, that slaves counted as three-fifths of a person for determining how many members of Congress Virginia or North Carolina would get. It would be the white population plus three-fifths of the black population. This obviously gave greater political weight to slave states than they would have had slaves simply not been counted at all. It was a compromise between saying they shouldn't count and they should count entirely.
Right. So that if it had been a direct election, they would have lost that three-fifths edge per slave.
Right, which would have been a very significant redistribution of electoral power among the states.
But what about after the slaves were freed? I understand there's a really ironic twist to the Southern advantage here. Could you talk about that a little bit?
There's a deeply ironic twist. The 15th Amendment is passed after the Civil War, and African Americans are technically enfranchised, and for a period of 10 to 20 years, depending on the state, they do participate in elections and they do vote, and then they are deprived of their voting rights by the end of the 19th century. The ironic consequence of that is that they are counted for full representation in the selection not only of members of Congress but of electoral votes.
Equal protection.
Right. And yet they still don't vote. So the consequence of the Civil War and Reconstruction is what I've come to refer to in several things I've written as the five-fifths clause.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, Southern states get full electoral power in national elections for their black populations, but their black populations don't vote. You know, I actually went and played with a few numbers, you know, on this, and you see things, for example, in 1910, there were more votes cast in New York and Pennsylvania, those two states alone, than there were votes cast in the entire South by a very large margin. And yet the South had twice as many electoral votes.
Yeah. No, it's truly remarkable. And I was just looking at some data for another reason, but I saw that as late as 1964, only 7% of the eligible African Americans were registered in the state of Mississippi, which just underscores your point about that entire population being represented in the number of electoral votes in Mississippi, but only 7% of the blacks actually even being eligible to vote. It's truly remarkable.
And it is a central fact of American political history for the first two-thirds of the 20th century that we don't pay that much attention to.
So let's move forward in time a bit. If I understand this correctly, the states themselves have always been able to decide how they will apportion their electoral votes. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. The Constitution says very clearly that each state can choose electors in a manner that the state legislature shall decide.
And how did they do that? Was it all or nothing from the very start?
In the 1790s, there were three different ways. In some cases, the state legislatures by themselves chose the electors.
Uh-huh.
No popular election. We'll just do it. In some, they did it with what was called the, quotes, general ticket, which is what we think of as winner-take-all.
Mm-hmm.
Others did it by district.
So winner-take-all, but now within the congressional district,
within,
not across the state.
Exactly. It was pretty much widely believed that the districting system was the most democratic, the most progressive, came the closest to expressing the will of the people.
It certainly strikes me as the most representative.
Absolutely. But when parties begin to form, what happens is that a certain partisan logic takes over, which
right.
is that if you have a party that is pretty sure to have a majority of a particular state but not 100% of the vote, it becomes in the interest of the party, if you think the election is going to be close, to have the state legislature decide to do it by winner-take-all. And
right.
that's precisely what happened in the 1800 election when Jefferson's backers in Virginia decided to do that, because in 1796, the Federalists had gotten five electoral votes, I think it was,
right.
and taken them away from the Democratic Republicans.
So they decided to lock in that victory of sorts.
Absolutely. And then Massachusetts retaliated,
right.
Doing the same thing.
And so that system is the one that we've inherited today. Is that correct? That for the most part, I mean, in fact, I think maybe 48 of the states have winner-take-all rules?
Yes, 48 states do winner-take-all. Maine and Nebraska are the sole exceptions. There have been some states along the way over the last 200 years that have for some period of time departed from winner-take-all and then got clobbered back into conforming.
Yeah.
But that's the system that we have today. And I should say, I'm a part of what's interesting. We have that system today despite what is an extraordinary and long record of dissatisfaction with the Electoral College. Getting rid of the Electoral College has been the subject of more constitutional amendments introduced into Congress than any other subject.
Wow.
There have been well more than 600 by now, starting in 1815 and going until recently. The other remarkable fact is during the period when we have public opinion polls, which is basically starting in about 1940,
mm-hmm.
between two-thirds and three-quarters of the American people have always wanted to get rid of the Electoral College. They've always favored a popular vote.
So to the billion-dollar question, this is democracy, right?
See, this is democracy. The reason we did not get a popular vote, a national popular vote, at least through the end of the 1960s, and we came very close in 1969, 1970, the reason for that, again, had to do with race. It had to do with this Southern advantage. To amend the Constitution requires supermajorities in Congress and among the states. And the Southern states were absolutely opposed to any kind of national popular vote.
Because they would lose that five-fifths advantage that you talked about.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay. But if that has been one of the big stumbling blocks, and if, in fact, through actions like the Voting Rights Act and the whole mobilization of the civil rights movement, we have dismantled that regime of Jim Crow, not to mention slavery, then what is holding this up? Don't we believe in one man, one vote, or as we'd say today, one person, one vote?
I think we do believe in one person, one vote, but I think that political elites and political actors believe in one person, one vote, and I need to be sure that we win the next election. And we have this problem of, foxes guarding the hen house. And I think the major obstacle to this right now is that particular political parties, particularly state political parties, but linked to national political parties, make the calculation that in a number of states, they have reliable majorities
right.
of, 55 to 70% in a presidential election.
Right.
With that reliable majority, they can pretty much count on delivering the state's entire block of electoral votes to their candidate, and they don't want to give that up. It is a way in which the parties, in effect at this point in our history, having control of the electoral rules, are impeding what would be a truly democratic reform.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure for me, Brian.
Alexander Kasar is a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He He is the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, and he is hard at work putting out a new edition, which is going to bring that book right up to the most recent election. Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you, Brian.
When you pull down all my levers for the person of your choice, you're also choosing state electors who will have the final voice. They're called the Electoral College, and they'll meet to stipulate who the voters have selected to be the winner in each state.
Well, guys, I really enjoyed that interview.
That was terrific.
I always thought that this was all about protecting the small states.
Yeah.
But after talking to Alex, I mean, what do you guys think? I didn't hear anything really about small states, at least in the 20th century.
I have a philosophical question I'd like to throw to you guys, though. I hear what you and Alex were saying about the preferability of district voting, but I want to know why the district is the unit that we should be thinking of as opposed to the state. What is it that makes a particular jurisdiction or unit or political society the proper context for discovering a majority? Why should a national vote trump state votes?
See, you're deeper than I am. I don't have any philosophical questions or answers.
Well, I had to call it philosophical. Yeah. So that you'd all take it seriously.
Well, Peter, I don't know. I think it's about the change in the presidency. And I think especially in the 20th century, the presidency has emerged as a national position, the one position that represents all of the people. So I think that there is a lot to be said for voting on the local level for local offices. Right. And there's a lot to be said for the constitutional structure of Senate and the House, and we have our representatives. But when it comes to the presidency, the one place we use this electoral system is the worst place to use it, because the presidency really has become the voice nationally of all of the people in reality.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say finally, and I'll give up on the philosophy, that the principle here that you're advocating is that there is a nation and a national electorate, and that we should think of it in unitary terms. And I'm just raising questions about that.
Yeah. No,
is there really a people whose will should be registered? Well, I don't know about that.
Well, that's a terrific question. In fact, far too good a question for us to answer. And that's why I want you out there to visit our website. Go to backstoryradio.org and tell us what you think. Is there really such a thing as a nation, as a national people?
But we don't really care about your individual vote. We'll weight your responses by the size of the state that you're from. Wherever you're from, however, you can find us at the same place, backstoryradio.org. And there you can sign up for our free podcast and for our weekly newsletter, which will let you know what shows we're working on and how you can take part in them.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to vote.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore.
Our engineer is Jamal Milner. Gabby Alter composed our theme, and Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory with American History Guys is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, and Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham.